Hi, this is the Scholastic Super STEM edition for October-November 2024. Front cover, a bat, busting bat myths, why there's so much to learn and love about bats. And they're talking about the flying kind, not the baseball kind. So we'll begin with the mini STEM reads, purple tomatoes. What do plums, blueberries, and blackberries have in common? The fruits are all purple. They get their color from a chemical called anthocyanin. It's good for your heart and brain. Now scientists have grown purple tomatoes that have the chemical too. In 2006, scientists copied genes from a purple snapdragon flower. Genes are bits of material found in cells that help determine an organism's traits. The scientists added two of the flower's genes to the tomato's 30,000 genes, and that caused the tomato to produce anthocyanin. It took years for scientists and plant breeders to develop a purple tomato that tasted like a red one. The seeds went on sale last spring. Maybe soon you'll get to try one. Next page, learning brick by brick. The raised dots on most Lego bricks allow you to snap them together, but last year, Lego released a special set of bricks with dots arranged for another purpose, to help people learn Braille. This system of writing is used by people who are blind or have low vision. Braille uses six raised dots to represent each letter and number. The dots are arranged in different patterns. People run their fingers over them to read them by touch. The new Lego Braille bricks can be used the same way. The dots on each brick are arranged to represent a number or a letter in the Braille alphabet. The special bricks come as a kit. Games and projects help make building and learning Braille fun for everyone. Also in the mini STEM reads, A Mess in Space. Last March, Alejandro Otero found a surprise in his Florida home, a metal scrap the size of a cell phone that crashed through his roof. It came from the International Space Station. That's a lab that orbits or circles Earth. After a section was released, this piece broke off. The metal scrap is one of millions of pieces of junk traveling around Earth. They range from rocket parts to specks of paint. In space, the objects can travel up to 9 miles per second. When they smash together, they can break into many pieces. And that junk can damage satellites, spacecraft that collect data and help communication on Earth. It also clutters paths for space missions. Scientists say it may take many years for all those objects to fall out of orbit, and we're still launching more. As small pieces enter the atmosphere, the layer of gases surrounding the planet, they burn up. But bigger pieces can stay intact and smash into buildings on Earth. Scientists use technology called radar to track space junk and try to prevent accidents. They also work with companies and governments to limit new junk and find safe ways to return spacecraft to Earth, rather than letting them fall apart in space. Even though humans are launching more satellites, if we work together, this can be managed, says Rob Margetta, who works at NASA. And there is a graph associated with this article that tracks space junk. The line graph shows the number of pieces of junk greater than 10 centimeters, 4 inches, orbiting Earth since 1960. And the line graph shows that in 1960, there was no space junk, and in 2020, it looks like there are 17,500 pieces of space junk orbiting us. Now we're on page 6 for the butterfly protectors. And before we begin the article, some STEM words to know. Endangered, in danger of dying out. Migrate, to travel from one place to another at regular times of the year. Predator, an animal that hunts and kills other animals for food. Nectar, a sweet liquid some plants produce to attract insects or other animals. Now on to the article. Every year on the first 2 days of November, images of monarch butterflies pop up across Mexico. People wear orange and black monarch costumes and paint their faces like butterflies. It's all part of the Mexican holiday Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead. On this day, communities across the country dance and share food as they remember friends and family members who have passed away. Monarch butterflies are one of the symbols of the holiday. The insects are thought to carry the souls of departed loved ones. As these celebrations take place, real monarchs arrive in Mexico, too. Every fall, they come by the millions from the U.S. and Canada. In the forests of central Mexico, the butterflies blanket tree trunks and branches. They rest in these forests until they leave in the spring. But in recent years, monarchs have been struggling to find places to rest. As a result of habitat loss and other threats, monarchs are now endangered. That's why residents of San Miguel Atlatla, a small town in Mexico, have taken action. Volunteers there are working to protect the monarchs that arrive in their area and share why the insects are incredible. Monarch butterflies are among many animals that migrate or travel to different habitats at regular times of the year. Monarchs are delicate insects that weigh less than a paper clip, but some make remarkable journeys. After spending their winter in Mexico, the butterflies head north. Along the way, they lay eggs on milkweed plants. Milkweed is the only thing monarch caterpillars eat. The plant contains chemicals that make the caterpillars and adult butterflies poisonous to predators like birds. During the spring, several generations of monarchs grow into adults through a process called metamorphosis. Some of those butterflies continue north, laying eggs along the way. These eggs grow into butterflies that also lay eggs. In late summer and early fall, the third or fourth generation of monarchs migrate south toward Mexico. The trip isn't easy. One reason is that people have cut down milkweed and other flowering plants. As a result, there is less food for monarchs during their migration. And that's why some people living along monarchs' migration routes plant butterfly gardens. The gardens contain milkweed for monarch caterpillars. They also have flowering plants that provide nectar for adult butterflies. Even a small pot of milkweed or other flowers can make a difference. Most monarchs spend winter in forests west of Mexico City. In the past, only a few butterflies appeared in San Miguel Atlatla, 150 miles east of their normal nesting grounds. But about 15 years ago, more butterflies began appearing in Atlatla. Residents have an idea for why that might be. They came here because people in other places were cutting trees illegally, says Gregorio Granados Baz. He heads the group that manages a protected area called Joya Redonda, Monarch Butterfly Sanctuary. To care for the monarchs, the town formed a group called the Atlatla Monitoring Brigade. Members patrol the sanctuary, making sure no one disturbs the resting insects. The group also gives tours of the sanctuary. Tour fees help support the work. The brigade's efforts seem to be paying off. Over the past few years, the sanctuary's monarch population has increased. The insects once occupied 4 trees, now they cover 42. As the Day of the Dead approaches, the butterflies remind Atlatla residents of loved ones who have passed away. Members of the brigade are proud to protect the monarchs that call the sanctuary home. I think they like it here, Granados Baz says. The next page is the STEM Vocab Lab. What you need to know about the STEM word metamorphosis. So ask your parent, teacher, or guardian to discuss the vocab lab with you. And more on the monarchs. A day is a monarch butterfly. The sun rises on a crisp fall morning in Missouri. You spend the night resting in a pine tree with dozens of fellow monarch butterflies. It was too cold in the dark for you to fly. When the temperature is below 54 degrees Fahrenheit, 12 degrees Celsius, you can't flex your wing muscles. But with the warmth of the morning sun, you'll soon be able to take off on your own. How did you get here? You hatched as a caterpillar about 2 months ago in a garden in Ohio, nearly 1,000 miles, 1,609 kilometers away. 2 weeks ago, you left your chrysalis as an adult butterfly. When the nights grew longer and colder, you knew you had to leave. Every day, you fly another 100 miles, 161 kilometers. You've never made this journey before, but instinct tells you exactly where to go next. It's the perfect day to fly. A light breeze pushes you through the air. As you glide southwest, small hairs along your body sense the speed and direction of the wind. You hold your wings wide so you can soar. The less you flap them, the less energy you use. Speaking of energy, you need to eat. To fuel your flight, you must drink a lot of nectar, a sweet liquid produced by flowers. At the top of your head are two antennae, long feelers with tips that you use to smell. They're 5,000 times more sensitive than a human nose. You flutter over treacherous highways and wide parking lots. There are big neighborhoods of houses with lawns full of bright green grass. No matter where you fly, you don't smell any flowers. A bird swoops in front of you. You quickly flap your wings to dodge its sharp beak. Your bright orange color is a warning. You're poisonous. Luckily, this bird has gotten sick from biting a monarch like you before. It flies away. You survived. Now that you're safe, you decide to keep searching for food. Finally, your antenna pick up a sweet scent. Could it be a garden? No, it's only a small pot of flowers on an apartment balcony, but that's enough. You land on a yellow goldenrod. Your tiny feet cling to the petals as you unroll your proboscis. This special tongue works like a straw, allowing you to sip each flower's sugary nectar. Ah, that hits the spot. When you're full, you flutter away. Your journey is one that monarch butterflies have taken for thousands of years. Eventually, you'll reach a warm forest in Mexico, where you'll spend the rest of your life. In the spring, the next generation in your family will begin the long journey back to Ohio. For now, you still have more than 1,000 miles, 1,609 kilometers to fly. Good luck! Next up, the science of goal. With 250 million players, soccer is the most popular sport in the world. Check out the science behind it. And there is a photo here of one soccer player, female, about to kick the ball. And there are captions associated with the photo that detail what's involved. Number one, a soccer kick starts when a player brings their leg back at the hip. The leg and foot are all full of potential energy. Two, the leg swings into the ball, striking it at up to 45 miles an hour. Kinetic energy transfers from the foot to the ball. And finally, number three, the force of the kick squeezes the ball together. Then it expands, giving it a boost of energy. The ball zooms off the foot at up to 60 miles an hour. In soccer, teams of 11 players compete to get the ball into their opponent's net. Except for the goalie who guards their team's goal, players can't use their hands. The main way players move the ball is by kicking it with their feet. They kick the ball differently if they're running with the ball, passing it, or shooting it. For most kicks, players strike the ball with the inside of their foot rather than their toe. Using this larger surface gives players more control over the direction the ball moves. Players can also control how much energy they move to the ball. They can softly tap the ball or send it speeding off their foot to their teammate or straight into the goal. And on the next page, on page 14, another photograph of soccer players, this one featuring male players. And again, the captions to go along with the various photo areas. Number one, Brazil's Danilo Luiz da Silva uses his legs to push down. The ground pushes back. He jumps up, positioning his head in the ball's path. Number two, just as the ball strikes da Silva's head, he pushes his head into the ball while twisting his neck. And number three, this small movement gives the ball energy and pushes it in a new direction. So use your head. Soccer players mainly move the ball with their feet, but when the ball is kicked high into the air, they often use a different body part to change its direction, their head. A shot or pass made with the head is called a header. During a header, the ball can strike a player's head with up to 300 pounds, 136 kilograms of force. Hits to the head can cause the brain to bounce back and forth inside the skull, leading to serious injury. And that's why experts recommend players younger than 12 avoid headers completely. For older players, it's important to use proper form during a header, and that means flexing their neck muscles and moving their head toward the ball. This causes their brain to bounce less inside their skull and helps prevent injury. Next is a photograph of a soccer player named Jaden Shaw. It shows her kicking the ball toward the goal using her toe to strike it just to the right of its center. Kicking the ball on its side causes it to spin in the air. The spinning ball pushes off the air on its right. The air pushes back, causing the ball to curve toward the goal. Jaden Shaw, a pro soccer player on the San Diego Wave, stands at the corner of the field. The ball sits on the ground before her. With a swift kick, she sends the ball soaring forward. At first, it moves through the air in a straight line, but then it does something strange. The ball starts to curve. It zooms past the goalie and into the net. Players often use this impressive shot during a corner kick after a ball has gone out of bounds. By causing the ball to turn in the air, a player can have a chance of getting it close to the goal, even when the angle looks impossible. It may seem like a magic trick, but it's not. The next section is physical science. Paddle that pumpkin. At a festival, people race boats made out of giant pumpkins. Scholastic editor Blair Rainsford reports. Before we begin the article, some STEM words to look for. Balanced, a condition in which opposite forces are equal to each other. Dense, having a lot of matter in a given space. Buoyant force, an upward force that can cause objects to float. Now on to the article. One day last October, I was visiting a small town in Maine called Damariscotta. The sun was shining in the bright blue sky, a cool breeze was blowing through the pine trees, and I was sitting inside a giant pumpkin. What was I doing there? Every autumn, the town hosts a week-long pumpkin celebration known as Pumpkin Fest. I had traveled there for the last event, the Pumpkin Regatta. It's a race where people carve giant pumpkins into boats, decorate them, and paddle them in the Damariscotta River. I was excited to get an up-close look at the race and learn how people turn giant pumpkins into wacky boats. The life of a pumpkin boat begins with a special seed. You can't grow a giant pumpkin with a regular pumpkin seed. You need one that came from another giant pumpkin. Giant pumpkin seeds are larger than other pumpkin seeds, but they're still just a few centimeters long. These seeds are planted in the spring. As their pumpkins grow, farmers give them a lot of care and water. A giant pumpkin might soak up as much as 150 gallons of water per day. The pumpkins need shade during the day and warmth at night. That's why many farmers even cover their pumpkins with blankets. Sweet dreams, pumpkin. Giant pumpkins don't typically end up perfectly round. As they grow, they get squashed under their own weight, making them flat on one side. The pumpkins grow for about 7 months. By October, they can weigh almost 2,000 pounds. Then they're ready to become boats. 2 days before race day, the racers begin building their boats. It's sort of like carving a giant jack-o'-lantern. I spent the day with a racer named Jaja Martin as she worked on her pumpkin. She has participated in the pumpkin regatta every year for more than 10 years. It's easier to stay afloat in a pumpkin boat that's balanced. But Martin's boat was smaller and more lopsided than she wanted. She would have to make it work. Martin first cut a hole in the flat side of her pumpkin. The hole had to be big enough for her to climb inside, but it couldn't be too big. Then water would splash inside and fill up the boat. When the boat fills with water, it becomes too unbalanced and tips over. That would make the paddler fall out. Pumpkin boats can float because they are less dense than the water around them. That water pushes up on the boats with a buoyant force that's stronger than the downward pull of the boat's weight. Martin painted her pumpkin bright pink. Then she scooped out the pulp and seed. She also scraped out the insides to make the pumpkin lighter. Finally, Martin painted details and added googly eyes. She let me climb into it, and it felt sturdy and strong. I almost forgot I was in a pumpkin. On race day, I got up early and went to the Damariscotta River. People lined up along the shore to watch. Large cranes lowered the pumpkin boats into the water. The water was cold that day, but the racers were used to it. They climbed in and grabbed their paddles. Honk! A horn went off and the race began. The racers had to paddle out to a buoy and back. At first, Martin was doing great, but then, splash! Her boat tipped over and she fell into the river. She wasn't surprised. It started to tip before I got into the boat, she says. I had to use a lot of my strength to keep it up. Martin swam to shore, laughing and waving to the crowd. There were a few more races after Martin's. In one, the boat builders even attached motors to their pumpkins. Some boats tipped over and some stayed afloat, but we all had fun. Now that I know the secrets and science behind making the perfect pumpkin boat, I want to try it. See you next year, racers. The next article, in a STEM vacation, a trip to the age of fishes. Before we begin, words to know, extinct, when a species no longer has any living individuals. Amphibian, an animal that usually lives part of its life in water and part on land. Vertebrate, an animal with a backbone. Evolve, to gradually change over a long period of time. Now on to the article. Imagine traveling about 359 million years back in time. You'd find yourself at the end of Earth's Devonian period, also known as the Age of Fishes. Our planet was very different then. Find out what it would be like to explore it. If you landed in a Devonian forest, you'd find some weird things. Plants had just developed wood trunks. That means you'd see the world's first trees. But you wouldn't spot any animals except insects. That's because most life was underwater. The Devonian's massive oceans were filled with strange creatures. Huge sea scorpions flashed claws longer than your arm. Spiral shells protected squid-like ammonites. Fish with armor-like bodies may have grown as long as a car. Devonian fish had armor for a reason. Many deadly creatures roamed the oceans during this time period, but the scariest one to meet would be a Dunkleosteus. This enormous armored fish had jaws with razor-sharp teeth. It could bite 16 times harder than a Nile crocodile. Yikes! You'd be safe from this fierce fish on land, but don't get too comfortable. At the end of the Devonian, most species went extinct. Scientists still aren't sure why. Some scientists think that volcanoes may have spewed ash into the air, blocking the sun and changing the climate. Others believe an asteroid or space rock might have smashed into Earth. If you traveled back to the Devonian period, you might meet a very special creature. A 10-foot-long, 3-meter salamander-like animal flopped along the banks of muddy lakes. It was the first fish to crawl onto land. Scientists call it Tiktaalik. They consider it to be the first amphibian. Tiktaalik developed bony fins and lungs that helped it survive outside of the water. It was the first vertebrate or animal with a backbone to do so. That means all birds, reptiles, and mammals eventually evolved from Tiktaalik, including humans. Without fish like it, we might not exist today. The climate during the Devonian was similar to today's. There was enough oxygen to survive, and the temperature on land was likely a spring-like 63 degrees Fahrenheit, 17 degrees Celsius, all year long. You might find it difficult to find food. There wouldn't be any fruits or vegetables. Luckily, the ocean would be full of fresh fish. To cook, you could bring an axe to cut down trees and build a fire. The Devonian's most exciting sights would be underwater. Scuba gear would be a must-have. Make sure to bring a weapon to protect yourself. A harpoon might do the trick. When taking a dip in Devonian waters, there is never a dull moment. And now we'll get to the cover article of this month's, well, it's actually October-November issue of STEM, Super STEM. I Stick Up for Bats. Kristen Lear works to protect bats and teaches people why they're awesome. Kristen Lear understands why some people find bats frightening. The nocturnal animals are often portrayed as spooky and dangerous. Say you're watching a scary movie and the characters are walking through a creepy house, she says. What's going to fly out and attack them? Bats. But this scene isn't realistic, says Lear. Bats aren't out to get us. In fact, many need our help. As a scientist at Bat Conservation International, Lear works to protect bats and their habitats. She recently spoke with SuperSTEM about sticking up for bats. Question, how did you become interested in bats? I've always liked animals that other people fear, like rats, snakes, and spiders. Bats have that image problem, too. They're out at night, so you don't usually get to see them. But that air of mystery is what draws me in. In sixth grade, I wanted to do a Girl Scout project to help animals. I decided to build bat houses. Those are artificial shelters where bats can rest during the day. I learned a lot about bats and what they need to survive. In college, I studied zoology, the science of animals. I got to work with bats hands-on. That's when I was hooked. Question, what do people misunderstand about bats? Bats make some people nervous because they're connected with darkness and nighttime. But they're wild animals just like birds or foxes. We can live alongside them. Because there are bats called vampire bats, people sometimes think all bats suck blood. But there are more than 1,400 species of bats in the world, and most of them eat insects. Others eat fruit or nectar from flowers. There are only 3 species of vampire bats, and they live in Mexico and Central and South America. They don't typically feed on people. When they bite other animals, they make a tiny cut and drink the blood with their tongues. Most of their victims don't even notice and go about their business. Question, why is helping bats important? Bats live on every continent except Antarctica. There are bats in deserts, cold places like Alaska, and cities. They play important roles in every ecosystem where they live. Bats that eat insects help keep pest populations under control. Fruit bats spit or poop out fruit seeds, which helps new plants grow. Nectar-feeding bats get covered in tiny pollen grains when they visit flowers. They carry the pollen from flower to flower, helping the plants to reproduce. Unfortunately, a lot of bats are losing their habitats. For example, people are cutting down forests where bats live. Bats need those natural areas to feed, hunt, and sleep. Without them, they may not survive. Question: how do you protect bats in your job? I work with three species of nectar-feeding bats that migrate between the southwest U.S. and Mexico every year. Along the way, they eat nectar from agaves, desert plants similar to cactuses. Like bats, agaves have also lost their habitats because of people changing the environment. My team is working to replant agaves and restore the land to a healthy state. To do that, we need to collect a lot of data. I want to know exactly where bats stop as they migrate. That helps us decide where to plant new agaves and which existing habitats need protection. Agaves can take more than 10 years to bloom and produce nectar, so it's important to think ahead. Question: what can people do to support bats? If you have a garden or a balcony, you can make a bat garden. If nectar-feeding bats live in your area, you can plant species they eat. If you plant flowers that bloom at night, they'll attract nocturnal insects for insect-eating bats to eat. Also, share your bat knowledge with friends and family. Over time, it can help more people come to appreciate bats. That's going to be the final article from Scholastic's Super STEM, their October-November 2024 edition. Thanks for listening and have a great day.